The views and opinions expressed on Gaza Corner are those of me, Dori Stein, and our guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of KALW Public Media. This Gaza Corner was recorded on September the 26th. Our guest is Mark Vanderhout of Vanderhout LLC. Mark is one of the attorneys representing Mahmoud Khalil in his immigration court case and his federal court challenge in the government's attempt to deport him. Mahmoud Khalil is a legal permanent resident of the United States who is a priority target for deportation by the Trump administration due to Khalil's advocacy for Palestinian rights and a free Palestine during the spring 2024 anti-genocide protests at Columbia University. Welcome, Mark. Thank you for making yourself available in Gaza Corner.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dori, for having me.
Describe who Mahmoud Khalil is and why this case is so important.
Well, besides being just an absolutely wonderful person, Mahmoud is a permanent resident of the United States. He is a graduate of a master's program at Columbia University, where he came to study. And
human rights, the master's program.
In human rights, correct. Yeah. And he has a wonderful young son who was born to his wonderful wife, Noor. Well, he was incarcerated by the government. And I have a story about being able to see and hold his son for the first time when we talk about that later on. And he is become the centerpiece of the Trump administration's attack on activists in this country, particularly Palestinian activists. And he's being made the centerpiece of the campaign to try to deport people and silence people and essentially prevent the First Amendment from applying to them, which is something that is unprecedented in recent times in U.S. history.
You would think someone like Mahmoud would be not targeted in a sense, because he was trying to mediate between the parties at Columbia. And, I mean, these are the kinds of activists that you really want to flourish. So how do you explain it?
That's correct. He became well-known in Columbia as somebody who was actively speaking out against what Israel was doing to Palestinians. But after October 7th and what was going on in throughout the United States and you know, really the world in protests, he became very public. And then, but you're right, once the what was called the encampment occurred at Columbia, where students took over large spaces outdoors in of Columbia space and occupied it, he was not part of the encampment, part of the entity that was doing that, the Columbia University Anti-Divestment and Apartheid Group. Rather, he was being asked by the administration, because of his credibility and his public presence, he was asked to be a mediator between the administration and the protesters. And yet he was targeted because he was such a well-known person speaking out against what was going on in Gaza. That's the bottom line.
Let's go back to the beginning. Tell me how the surveillance of Mahmoud Khalil began.
Yeah. So they started a campaign to go after people, and they targeted him in that capacity for sure. And they started following what he was doing. There was efforts to monitor him, unbeknownst to him, of course, and target him with the idea of eventually arresting him and trying to deport him.
I think it's important to, I mean, if this is something you know about, the efforts of surveillance, there's a far-right Zionist youth group, Beitar, that sent Mahmoud's information to the government saying that he's on our deportation list, quote-unquote.
Correct.
There's a guy named Ross Glick, another Zionist activist, who discussed Mahmoud Khalil with Ted Cruz and John Fetterman. The Intercept reported on a WhatsApp group at Columbia with, you know, Columbia alumni and parents who discussed, among other things, reporting student protesters to the NYPD, the FBI, ICE, although it's not clear if Mahmoud Khalil was targeted. I think Canary Mission, you can talk about them if you want. But there's also this feeding system to the government of a hit list, essentially, and Mahmoud is top of the charts.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened was when these protests became very effective, two Jewish groups got separately initially and then together, Betar and Canary Mission, started to name people publicly, doxing them. Then they started providing information to the Trump administration on them and basically said, you should go after these people. And they gave them a list of people, and Mahmoud was number one on their lists. And they eventually, the administration did no separate investigation. They, as far as we could tell from everything we've been able to discover, they took the names and went out to go and arrest them, bottom line, based on what these two potentially Jewish and very pro-Israeli...
Zionist groups,
because it's very important to point out that there were many, many, many Jewish groups and you know, thousands upon thousands of Jewish individuals who were very opposed to what Israel and still are, has been doing in Gaza, and were active in the protests, whether it was Jewish Voice for Peace or many, many, many other organizations of Jewish people who protested, you know, loudly and very effectively, saying, you know, not in my name. You know, you're not speaking on behalf of me when you're doing this, Israel. And so it's the Zionist groups that were, in particular Zionist groups that were targeting. I mean, you could have people who believe in Zionism who were not actively trying to get people deported from the United States, but there were very, you know, right-wing Zionist groups that were doing that. And the, you know, right-wing administration under Trump basically took everything in and just went after them with, as far as all the information we have, without any separate investigation whatsoever.
Our guest is Mark Vanderhout, one of the members of the legal team representing Mahmoud Khalil. The government agrees that Mahmoud Khalil has not committed a crime.
Correct.
Yet, he was arrested on March 8th. Take us through that.
Yeah, well, so there's no allegation that he's done anything illegal at all in his life, to tell you the truth. No crime committed, no crime alleged, certainly no terrorist activity in any way. But he was an effective and important advocate and opponent of what Israel is doing in Gaza. So groups like Beitar, like Canary Mission, wanted people like him gone after by the administration. They knew they had an ally in Trump and his cronies, and they essentially fed his name. So they undertook some surveillance of him. They started to monitor his activities, his whereabouts. They had agents assigned to monitor his neighborhood, his apartment building, etc. And on the night of March the 8th, he was returning home with his wife, and he was approached by, I think it's four, he didn't know who they were at the time, but four people who grabbed him, asked him for his identification, said, "Are you Mahmoud Khalil?" And he said, "Who are you?" And they eventually said, we're from ICE, we're arresting you. We're from Homeland Security Investigations, actually. And we're arresting you, and your student visa is being canceled." And he said, "Student visa? What are you talking about? I'm a permanent resident."
Right.
And they went, "What do you mean?" And he said, I'm a permanent resident. Let me see your green card. Well, it's up in my apartment." So his wife, Noor, goes to get it. In the meantime, one of the officers goes over, and you could hear them talking and getting on the phone. and saying he claims he's a permanent resident. And so this was the beginning. And it turned out he was a permanent resident. So instead of bringing a charge of, you know, we're revoking your student visa is being canceled for whatever reason they would come up with, they brought out a statute which has only been used, to my understanding and knowledge, six times in history. It was put into law in the 1990 Immigration Act, when they essentially got rid of all the McCarran-Walter Act anti-communist provisions. And that was based on a lawsuit that we had done when I was representing a group called the Los Angeles Eight in Los Angeles, where they're going after a group of seven Palestinians and one Kenyan wife of one of the permanent residents. And they charged them with, you know, at that point it was distributing literature that advocates the economic and international doctrines of world communism. That was the charge they brought against the LA 8. And we challenged that on constitutional grounds. We were successful, and they eventually changed the statute and got rid of all those communist era 1950s grounds charges. The McCarran-Walter Act was put in effect in the middle of the communist anti-communism era in 1952. And they essentially put into effect in 1990 what is the essence of the political ideological grounds now, except they call them anti-terrorism grounds. And it's important to know this. These are not really anti-terrorism provisions. But with Mahmoud, they admitted it was based on First Amendment protected activity. The statute says that the deportation ground is if the Secretary of State determines that your presence in the United States have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences, then you are deportable. And it says, if there's that determination, and it's based on what would otherwise be First Amendment protected activity, you know, speech or activities that are protected by the First Amendment, that you cannot be deported unless the Secretary of State personally signs and determines that your presence would be contrary to the interests of the United States or potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences. So that's the first time that has ever been brought in this context.
So we're talking about Marco Rubio, and you clearly have a very strong case to debate that, but you weren't even given a chance to depose him, correct?
We were not. Oh, I should mention, by the way, and this is part of their strategy now in all these cases and in many cases. He was arrested in New York, where he was living, and he was arrested at 9 at night on a Saturday night, or 9:30 at night in that range on a Saturday night. He was taken downtown New York to a nice facility, processed there, then sent over to New Jersey, where they were going to supposedly keep him, but they decided very quickly that they didn't want to do that, and they shipped him to Louisiana in the middle of nowhere. Why? Because there's, first of all, very few immigration lawyers down there. Secondly, they're in a very conservative court system down there in a detention center in Louisiana, the immigration court system. And thirdly, and probably most importantly, if you do any appeal, your appeal is to what's called the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is probably the most conservative court of appeals in the country. It's a level before the United States Supreme Court. So that was all part of a tactic, and they sent him there, assuming everything would have to be litigated there. Luckily, he had a very wonderful attorney who was a criminal defense attorney in New York who was representing him in his disciplinary proceedings, which he was facing at Columbia. So he called her.
Who was that?
Amy Greer, her name is.
Okay.
Anyway, she had a habeas corpus petition filed by 3:30 in the morning. Because she was able to get in there, we've been litigating the federal court case in New Jersey rather than Louisiana, which is where the government had wanted this to be fought.
How did it evolve so that relying on that arcane act, which would negate freedom of speech, was dropped essentially, and an added allegation about his green card came into the picture?
So what happened was, after there was essentially worldwide protests against this, an outrage, that they would bring a charge, again, the first time in history that they did this, saying that they could deport someone for what clearly First Amendment protected activity, because the Secretary of State says it's his presence in the United States might have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences. Now, what on world would Mahmoud Khalil, a student at Columbia, individual student at Columbia, how could his presence in the United States have any potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences? It is absurd. Absurd, absolutely absurd. And yet this immigration judge ruled that she couldn't go behind it, didn't have to assert whether there was a reasonable basis for it. So it's clearly, clearly, clearly that they wanted to stop both him from speaking out against what the U.S. government was doing, what Israel was doing. But not only that, they were making him an example, so that people throughout the country would not speak out. Because if they were not U.S. citizens, they were afraid of being deported. So whether it was a permanent residence, a lawful permanent residence, who'd been a permanent resident for 30 or 40 years, or a student who was here on a student visa, or anyone else in this country, would be intimidated and afraid to speak out. And that's what they were trying to do, and still are trying to do.
So again, what about the additional allegation about falsification of the green card?
Yeah. Thank you for bringing me back to that. So after the worldwide protests that happened right away, they decided to fabricate an additional charge that on the papers did not look like a political charge. They charged him with being deportable for having been what's called inadmissible at the time of admission to the United States as a permanent resident, on the basis they asserted that he lied on his green card application about certain things. Now, let me be clear what they were, because there's been a lot of things in the paper about, these allegations about lying on his green card. So it's important to explain the three allegations, all of which are completely absurd and baseless. One was that he didn't list that he was employed at the British Embassy when he filled out his green card application, when in fact that employment had ended 3 years before. So the immigration judge, this one charge, she had to say, well, that's baseless. But the other two, she sustained. And it's important for your listeners to know what they were. One of those two was that he lied on his green card application because, to the answer to a question of list all your employment, he listed Columbia University for one of the two summers when he was at Columbia. And Columbia paid his salary, so it was perfectly valid to put down and required to put down that Columbia was his employer. But he was placed at the United Nations. So he was working at the United Nations, but Columbia was his employer. And the reason that they claim he hid it is UNRWA, which is the United Nations entity that deals with Palestinian refugees. And they claim that he should have put down UNRWA instead of Columbia. Of course, if you put down UNRWA instead of Columbia,
they may have blamed it.
They would have said, you're hiding the fact it was Columbia because they're the one who paid you. Absolutely absurd. And then the other one was that he didn't list that he was allegedly, a member of QUAD, the Columbia University Anti-Apartheid and Divestment organization that we talked about earlier. Two things on that. He was not a member of QUAD. There are no individual members of QUAD, only organizations. But more importantly, he filled out his residency application 3 months before the encampment even started there. And their position, absurd as it may be, and he was one of the few people who actually got his green card granted without even an interview, because the application was so clean, which rarely happens. Plus, even if it were true, so what? If there were membership, he could be a member of the Columbia University Anti-Apartheid and Divestment Group. There's nothing illegal about that. That's protected by the First Amendment.
So what's the consequence of these two points that the Louisiana judge, as ludicrous as it may seem, she made them stick as far as the falsification? So what was the consequence of that?
What's the situation right now is that in the federal court challenge to his deportation, we got the first ground, the foreign policy ground, declared unconstitutional on due process ground. It was unconstitutionally vague, because what does that mean? Your presence in the United States might have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences. How is anyone supposed to know if the Secretary is going to think your presence in the United States might have adverse foreign policy consequences? How would one be put on notice about that? That's called constitutional vagueness. And so the district court judge declared that unconstitutional, or likely to be. It was a preliminary injunction, so likely to be unconstitutional.
That was New Jersey?
That was the New Jersey federal court judge, okay, who declared that relatively recently in June unconstitutional. Unfortunately, it took 3 months to do that. And in the meantime, they raced ahead in his deportation case. And we had a hearing in May on the false statement charge. And astoundingly, the immigration judge ruled that those were both willful and material misrepresentations, those two items I mentioned, and found them deportable on that, as absurd as what you may think that is, or people may think that is.
I'd like to hear the story that you mentioned right at the beginning of Gaza Corner. When he was arrested, his wife was 8 months pregnant, so she gave birth to their only child while he was in a prison in Louisiana. Describe the first moment of Mahmoud seeing his child.
Yeah. What happened in May, we went down to Louisiana to do his hearing on May 22nd, I think is the date. And we arranged for a meeting with his legal team. And we wanted him to be able to see his baby for the first time, because he was in jail. This was a month after his child, Dean, was born. And so Noor, his wife, brought Dean down there to be able to see him. And the detention facilities and the ICE officials down there wouldn't let him hold his child. Hmm. They wanted him to meet with his wife through one of these prison visiting rooms. Prisoners on one side of the plexiglass and the person visiting is on the other. There's a little round hole where they can talk through. And that's where they insisted he be. So we had to go to federal court. Just absurd. We had to go to federal court in New Jersey to get a federal court order to allow him to be with his wife and be able to see the baby in a meeting that we had in federal court. In immigration proceeding, court ordered an in-person meeting where we could talk in private about all the legal issues that we had to deal with in private that involved both him and his wife. So that's how we finally was able to hold his baby for the first time. But just absurd.
So let's bring it to the present. There was recently a deportation order for Mahmoud Khalil. So bring us up to speed on that.
Yeah. On June 11th, Judge Farbia, as a district court judge in New Jersey, enjoined the use of that foreign policy ground as unconstitutionally vague and said it cannot be used, at least on a preliminary injunction basis. 9 days later, we're in an argument with Judge Farbia's on another part of the case. And in the middle of that oral argument, the immigration judge issues a decision in writing that we received during the hearing, ignoring the federal court order from 9 days earlier and finding him deportable on the foreign policy ground and then denying him relief, even if one is found removable on or deportable on the false statement allegation, there's normally a waiver available for that, which is a discretionary waiver, which says, okay, you did this thing, but it's not so bad. We're still going to let you stay in the United States as a permanent resident. And that would be, in this situation, would be granted, you know, 99% of the time, because even if these allegations were true, and even if you believe them to be willful and material, in the discretionary relief situation, where there's a U.S. citizen child, a U.S. citizen wife, you would not, 99% of the time, the judge would never find them deportable for it, would never deny the waiver. She refused to even hold a hearing on the waiver or address the waiver, saying he was ineligible for a waiver because the foreign policy ground overrides that and he would be deportable on that, so there was no reason to even reach the second ground. That was even though 9 days earlier she had been enjoined from considering it. And Judge Farbia said, after she reported that, said, well, it's hard for me to believe that an immigration judge is going to ignore a federal court order, but we don't have to deal with that right this moment because I'm addressing a different issue and can resolve your case on a different issue. And ultimately, in that hearing, did order his release from custody for the first time. But a couple weeks ago, she came out with a new decision, finding him deportable again on the false statement charge. And I'm not going to allow a hearing because I'm going to declare you ineligible for a waiver, an outrageous decision which we will be appealing. First time that I've ever seen that in over 40 years of practice. You know, she's under orders. It's right. Clear she's under orders from the White House, who's controlling this case through Stephen Miller, from high ups in the Justice Department who are dealing with the prosecution in the federal court. And it's a sham. It's a total sham.
Normally, I mean, you went to law school. You've been doing this for 40 years. When you go to court, when you fight a case, you're fighting to interpret the law better for your client. Here, it really seems like you're playing poker and you have a weaker hand because it's a stacked deck.
It's a totally stacked deck. You know, you've got the full force of the administration, you know, including Trump and Rubio have specifically made comments about Mahmoud. They have specifically labeled him a Hamas supporter, and I mean, which is totally untrue. And many, many statements, outrageous statements, both Trump and Marco Rubio have made. And even if they weren't saying anything directly to the immigration judge, which we believe they are, the atmosphere would be such that this judge would not go against that in a million years. And, you know, she's a Trump appointee as an immigration judge, and there's no way she would be going against that, even if she wasn't under direct orders, and we believe she is, quite honestly. I believe she is.
Our guest is Mark Vanderhout, one of the members of the legal team representing Mahmoud Khalil. And as we wrap up, let's make it clear that she, in her deportation ruling, said that he should be deported to Algeria or Syria.
And the alternative, Syria, correct.
Yeah. He was born in Syria.
He was born in Syria. His family fled 1948 Israel, went to Syria, been refugees for decades, and he was born there.
Let's end on this. If you lose the appeal, what's next?
Well, there's two avenues. On the immigration court directly, we would go to what's called the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. The country is divided into a dozen circuits in the country, and over Louisiana and Texas is the Fifth Circuit. As I said before, the most conservative in the country, which is why they sent them there. And that's what our next level would be. And in the district court, we're still challenging the government's attempt to deport them on both grounds. We already got an injunction on the foreign policy ground. We're going back in this coming week again on the alleged, what we call the post hoc charge, the charge that they added when they knew they were in trouble on the foreign policy ground charge. And we're going back into court to challenge that as a retaliation for his First Amendment protected activity.
However this shakes out, it will be a momentous decision. And if he is deported, I think it's fair to say this would be a new precedent in suppression of freedom of speech. And not just
it would be
not just speech that is anti-genocide, which, by the way, anti-genocide is completely consistent with Jewish values. So the whole idea of that position being anti-Semitic is terribly ironic, because
the way that the Zionist movement has, and the, you know, the Trump administration has labeled his statements in favor of a Palestinian state, against what Israel is doing in Gaza, as being anti-Semitic, being Hamas supporter, is outrageous.
There's two articles that are posted at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist at tangents.com. You go to the left-hand column and click on the Tangents playlist and scroll down. Thank you, Harry, for posting them. But one of them is an article by Kenneth Stern. He crafted the so-called IHRA definition, which has been adopted by the Trump administration. And he says himself how it's being weaponized to silence speech, and it never intended to be used that way. So if you want to learn more about that definition, go to the Tangents website. If he's deported, not only will this be absolutely chilling for speaking out against genocide and for speaking out for Palestinian rights, but you could apply it to anything.
You can. That's why I think so many people from so many different walks of life and so many different political perspectives have said, this is outrageous. We've got to speak against it. Even if we don't agree with what Mahmoud is saying, he's got a right to say what he says. And if they can stop people like Mahmoud from speaking, who is next? And that's what this is really all about, this case.
Thank you, Mark. Mark Vanderhout of Mark Vanderhout LLC, one of the lawyers representing Mahmoud Khalil. And we will definitely be glued to how this progresses. Thanks for making the time, Mark.
Thank you, Dory. Appreciate you having me on, and I'm glad you're running this.